We wanted to make sure we gave them as much time as possible. I'm Harold Lindemann, and with me in the studio are Kathy and E.B. Lux. And on the phone, we have Kim Craigs, champion dry lake racer, and Stephen Matthews, champion beach racer. You're there, guys.
We are. G'day, E.B. and Kathy.
How are you?
Welcome to the show. And I hope you watched. I hope you listened to the show last week and caught Ross Noble.
Well, no, I'm going to see if I can actually. Can I download it off the internet?
No, you can't do that. But it has been loaded onto the MRASA webpage. It's MRASA.asn.au, and you'll find the link there. So certainly, or alternatively, just give me a call again. You can find my number on the MRA page, or Kathy or Harold.
That's for anyone that missed the show last week or wants to listen to it again. I've listened to it at least once.
Yeah, we were listening to it on the way down here from home, and because it's a reasonably lengthy drive, we got through a fair bit of it, and people must have been wondering what the hell we were on, because we were wetting ourselves laughing again.
it was fantastic. I listened to it, Kim, and I can highly recommend it. It was a really good hour of interesting talk about motorcycles, and I had no idea how involved Ross Noble is with motorcycling, and he's just done so much. I was scheduled to be on the show last week, and I was so glad I didn't get on, because his achievements outshine mine. Like, he's just so into motorcycles. He's a funny man, but he's also very much into motorcycling in a serious way. It's not just a bit of fun for him. He takes it seriously.
He rides a GS, doesn't he?
He rides all sorts.
You name it, he's got it off. I think he's primarily into KTMs at the moment.
He's into trials riding at the moment. That's his biggest thing. So he's gone from road to dirt to very much off-road, racing in all sorts of inclement conditions. And now he's doing trials, which he's thoroughly enjoying. Yeah.
But, you know, like I said to him last week, everybody that comes on this show has some sort of dedication towards motorcycling. And, you know, like you guys are giving your time up to be here now, you know, to be on air and talk to our audience. Ross gave up his time to be on this show. This is a bloke who commands top performance rights from guys like Parky and so on, yet he talks to us.
Fantastic. Well, motorcyclists are like that, though.
They are.
We're
mad.
Yeah. And we're always on the lookout for ordinary people who are extraordinary motorcyclists.
Exactly.
And we've got two of them on tonight. So welcome to the show again, guys. It's really good to have you back. And let's start off with Kim. How's the last couple of weeks been for you?
Look, to be honest, I'm on a descending plateau. We got washed out by the weather. So our annual speed trials with the dry lake races, we experienced weather. So I didn't get to swing my leg over the bike at all the whole race meet. So hence I'm on a descending plateau of being on an absolute high for being at Lake Gairdner on the Salt Flats. I've been surrounded by friends, my salt racing family that I haven't seen since 2019, but not getting to race. So I've just kind of landed just now, really.
Yeah, so how's the swimming?
Well, you know, because last year it was probably 2 weeks, or maybe 10 days, before our 2020 event, which was going to be our 30th anniversary of running the speed trial. We had to pull the pin because of the COVID pandemic. So, you know, not having seen your fellow racers for a long time, your fellow Mad Hatters, that was always going to be the good part. This time around, guys, we had brilliant weather for the 4 days where we were setting up the racetrack and the pits and the whole event. We had beautiful weather. Then on the first 2 days of racing, we had what could only be described as windy conditions. All right for bikes and cars that weren't as susceptible to the wind, like, you know, not meaning to sound derogatory, but, you know, bikes that weren't going particularly fast. Then way too windy for us with all the bodywork that we carry. And then on Wednesday, the heavens opened up and dumped over an inch of rain, and that was the end of the race meet. The lake stayed sodden.
So, what, the surface was that soft that you just couldn't use it at all? Is that right?
No, the surface, this is the weird thing about the lake. The surface stays rock hard, but there was standing water. The salt in summer is so rock hard that it doesn't really, the rain doesn't drain into the salt. It requires the wind to push the water around. And the wind, had we had the wind that we had at the start of the week, it would have been terrific. It would have blown all the water away, but it got quite calm after that rain, so the water just sat there. We gave out, you know, so Wednesday it rained all day, and then on the Thursday, the sun came out, but there wasn't a breath of wind. So we were in hope that we'd be able to race, but the lake, we still had about, would have been about 10 centimetres of standing water on our short track, our 4-mile-long track, and intermittent coverage of water along our main track, which is 10 miles long. By morning of Friday, we just had to call the race event off. There was no way that there was enough dry salt for us to run. So it stayed rock hard, it just had standing water on it.
Mm. Even though the day was forecast to be about 37 degrees, and that's pretty hot.
Oh, yeah, and it was. But again, it's the wind that pushes the water around, not so much the evaporation, because it's a weird little micro environment, the salt flats. Because it's a white surface, there's not a lot of heat generated off the salt, because it
doesn't absorb the heat.
Mm.
Exactly, yeah. So you just don't quite get that evaporation. So bring on 2022, I say.
So will 2022 be classified as your official 30th, or will it now be the 31st?
Yeah, that's hilarious. That's a really good question. Our race meet, we did have, for the machines that were able to compete in the windy days of the Monday and Tuesday, the first 2 days, the race meet still happened. On day one, we had 18 machines set records, and on day two we had another 12 machines set records. So all up, you know, we broke on 30 existing land speed records. Event 30/31, a hybrid of the last 2 years, was a success for the first 2 days. So 2022 will be our 32nd race meet.
Right. Okay. Oh well, fair enough. I suppose you just got to celebrate extra hard.
That's right.
Yeah. Actually, now, if I can just digress back to Stephen for a minute. Stephen, I've got a text from you saying it's, to use slightly different words, it's a little bit damp down at the Selix Beach racing as well on the Saturday. How did that affect you guys?
It made the day rather short. We got up to drizzling rain. I was up at about 5 in the morning and down at the track at about 5:30. It was drizzling when we got there, and then to use the Norse word, it siled down. I was on the gate, got nominated to be on the gate early to let the competitors and officials in, and with my daughter, and drenched to the skin. Luckily, I hadn't changed into my race gear, and at 8:30, they called rider's brief, so I went to rider's brief dripping water, and it continued to pour down while we were in rider's brief, and it was a westerly wind which blew the water up onto the beach. So at about 8:30, we had water up to the top of the boat ramp. On the beach, there was no beach at all, and we had the spectators queued up in the rain, wanting to get in, but we had nowhere to put them because there was no beach for them to stand on. And that continued on, and then as the morning went on, there was sort of a bit of beach appear, but it was 11 o'clock before we could get underway, and even then there were large puddles on the beach, and it was not an 800 metre run down the beach in a straight line. It was a zigzag around the big pools of water, and although there's some spectacular photographs of bikes deciding to go straight through the puddles, and you can imagine 362 bikes hitting water at speed, there was I think there was 40 bike retrievals on the Saturday, and we only got through 15 races because it was not fun. But like all bike racing, it'll be a day that people talk about for a long time, because if everything goes smoothly, people forget because it's just normal. So it was horrendous, but you know, in the pits, my pit had 3 or 4 centimetres of water in the pit, so it was a bit muddy and sloshy, and you know, not much fun for those who were trying to work on bikes. And yeah, an interesting day. But then we were blessed on Sunday that the sun was just shining. The Saturday the beach was chopped up, and so people had some issues with some whoops down the beach. Sunday presented a beautiful flat beach that provided some really good racing. So we were lucky. We had one great day.
Oh, at least you got there. That's the important thing.
And on that note, we'll go to a couple of messages and then we'll come back and talk to you a bit more. And you're listening to Adelaide's Coast FM 88.7. The show is Moto Chat with Harold, Cathy and Ebi. And our guests tonight are Kim Krebs and Stephen Matthews.
Now, Kim, if I can just ask a silly question. You were the world record holder for your class. Is that record still standing?
Yes, it is. Wow. So I have the fastest 750, turbocharged 750 in the partial streamline class. So that record still stands at 229 miles an hour.
Wow.
So just for folks who aren't that familiar with land speed racing, your record is set by your two-way average, so it's hard enough going fast one way, let alone within 2 hours turning around and going in the opposite direction and going fast again. So so we're still holders for that record. And I think I'm pretty sure I still have the outright fastest woman in Australia, cars and bikes, but I could be wrong on that one. With those 244 miles an hour as a one-way pass.
Whichever way, Kim, it's
that's the one you did in.
I thought you were going to ask me to convert it to kilometres. I'm going, oh no, I can't.
That was in 2016 at Bonneville.
That's right. That was a good year for us, 2016.
Yep. Actually, now that's that actually raises another question for me. Now, you know, I've got to ask the dumb questions here because I don't know. Wherever you set the record, does that make it a world record or does it make it a track record, a world record for that track?
Good question. So when you race in Australia at Lake Gairdner, then you're setting a club record for the Dry Lake Races Australia. But because we are the only event, the only speed trials in Australia, that's the equivalent of an Australian record. When you race at Bonneville, if you were to enter the Bonneville Motorcycle Speed Trials, which is the bike-only event, that's sanctioned by Motorcycling America, so the same as our Motorcycling Australia, American Motorcycling Association. And that's the equivalent of setting an American land speed record. You can only set a world record if you've actually entered an event where you've entered as a competitor under FIM, so the Federation of International Motorcycling. And that can only happen at the Bonneville Motorcycle Speed Trials or... every couple of years in Australia at the Dry Lake Races meet, we bring FIM over to sanction records. So most of the time, so long answer, but most of the time you're only setting national records. It's only at, unless it's a sanctioned FIM event, that you set world records.
So, to ask Stephen the same question, is yours a world record, or is it an Australian record, or is it a Selix Beach record?
I'm being baited here, and I know that. I said, sometimes you say things in jest, and then you have to live with it for a long time. So, in 2017, I managed to win the... pre-World War II 250 class, and at the celebrations afterwards, I said, well, it was the only beach race of its type in the world, and so therefore it was a world championship, which the people in my motorcycle club took to their hearts and started calling me the world champion. And when I won that class again this year, the announcer introduced me as defending world champion in front of the crowd, and I apologise to everyone else that's ever won a world championship for denigrating that title. But it's become a very broad in joke for a lot of people now. So I have legends in motorcycling like Murray Williams, who's a Hall of Fame with motorcycling in South Australia, who now greets me as world champ every time he sees me. And you know, this guy's achieved more than I will ever dream of achieving. But he said it quite seriously, you know, how are you going, world champ? So, no, it's not a world championship. It's a very unique event, which has grown in stature, I must admit. It's, people have really taken this event to their hearts, and it was very, heartwarming at the presentations. We had a guy that won his class, got up on the podium, and then was interviewed and said that he'd raced cars and bikes all over the world, and it's the best event that he's ever been to.
That's brilliant.
Which was huge praise, and and certainly, you know, it's for a little club, mountain bike club that runs it, it's a really good event and good fun. And you know, Kim was saying before about meeting her racing friends after that break, and you know, that feeling in the pits at Selix reflects very much what she was saying. You meet people and they have this feeling about racing. You get in the pits, everyone helps each other, everyone's there to, it's not about winning, it's about being there. And you know, if somebody has a problem, there's six or eight people there immediately saying, how do we fix this? Great feeling.
You never have to walk more than two or three pits along to get your answer, to get the spare part that you're after, to get the advice. Such a wonderful family.
Kim, I hate to tell you this, you obviously haven't seen Stephen's bike.
In all seriousness, Stephen, the Selix Beach Racing, is there anything else like it in the world? Is it, as you said, you called it unique. Is there any other beach racing?
The Birdman.
Well, there is. There's modern beach racing somewhere in Queensland, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we're restricted because of council dictates that we're pre-1962 bikes, so it's all historic bikes. They do race on the beach in New Zealand. There's the Burt Munro Festival, and they have racing over there. I'm not sure their format. So, look, it's we'll claim that it's unique and it's the only one of its sort. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'll still claim that it's the only sort in the world, and therefore I'm a world champion. Yeah.
I believe the Burt Munro beach racing is more display than anything else. I don't know whether it's...
Well, it could be. It could very much be a demonstration, and that's the thing. This is actually a permitted event. It's sanctified by MA. It's permitted under them. So, yeah, it's a genuine race meet and run as such, which probably does make it unique in that sense. So we're very, very proud of it, and it's great to be involved in it. I must say also that I'm involved in the organisation, the club that runs it.
The Levis Club,
And, you know, there's a there's a small group of people who put it together, and there are a very small number of people who spend 6 months to 12 months before it's on, making sure that it works and that it's managed properly. And, you know, we tick all the boxes for the council first, yeah. And then run it properly and leave the beach in better condition than we actually find it. So on the Monday and Tuesday after the event, I was wandering around the car park and where the pits had been picking up rubbish that probably was there before we got there, but just to make sure that everything was left, you know, in a good condition, because we need to do that to make sure that the event will continue.
Yeah, so you were the
I one... I reckon, Stephen, that's something that's really... There's a bit of a theme here, because that's very much the same for us with Dry Lake Racing Australia, DLRA. We solely depend on volunteers to make the event happen. Our club is... We are an amateur sports enthusiast club, and we've been running for 30 years now. We run the second only event in the world. There's only two events across the whole planet. But we are reliant on our competitors volunteering, their pit crew volunteering to make sure that the event happens. And I reckon that's part of us being, that's why you're a world record holder, Stephen, because we're doing something that is really quite unique. It's an intimate affair, but it's an extremely competitive experience at the same time. And we need our volunteers, and we need people who've got that kind of spirit.
Absolutely. And you know, during the event, these things don't happen without a great number of people doing jobs that aren't actually all that interesting or that involved. You know, we've got one guy that comes along and helps organise the car park. Now, we have a local football club that actually run it, but he's got to manage it from the organiser's point of view. And this guy spends, you know, nearly all day involved in car park and traffic control, and sees some racing at the end of the day, and you think, well, you know, how good is that that someone would do that? Because it'd be easy to say no and just buy a ticket and go and watch. And so, yeah, we do. The sport... As a sport, is very much we survive because of volunteers, and that's because people are enthusiastic about what we do, and we all we tend to all pitch in and do our bit. So I know there were people somebody that I race with probably got about 6 hours sleep for the whole weekend and raced. But had the biggest smile on his face at the end of the whole thing, because it worked.
Actually, Harold Eby and I know exactly what it's like to do the volunteer. We haven't ridden the toy run for so many years, I can't remember.
I can't remember how many years.
So organising a function like that for motorcycles particularly is an extremely time-consuming...
But toy run's a huge thing. I mean, it's the organisation that goes into that is amazing, and I've ridden that since I think the first one. I only missed a couple of years for various reasons, but you know, I see you guys there every year, working your butts off, seriously. And if you weren't doing that, all those thousands of people couldn't be doing what they're doing. So you know, hats off to you.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, now I've got a couple of other serious questions I want to ask, but the first one I've got... I think we've actually got to go to a word from our sponsors first, but when we come back, I want to talk about the preparation that both of you guys put into preparing your bikes and getting yourselves ready for the events this year. So think about that while we're on the break.
Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Okay.
We have news...
Excuse me. He actually asked a question. Now, Kim, actually for both of you, what got you into riding in the style that you do? So for yourself, Kim, it's, you know, sort of the fast on the Salt Lakes. What actually got you into that?
I used to go to Phillip Island every year for the Superbikes and the GPs. I haven't been there for the last couple of years, I'll confess. But, you know, creatures of habit, I camp at the same spot every time down at the campground on the island, and made friends with this fella. I'd see him twice a year, and this fella was Greg Waters, who I, as of 2016, I raced with him. But he had, in 2005, he had his first glimpse at the salt. And when I met him later that year, it would have been the Superbikes, no, it would have been the GP in October that year, he says to me, "Kim, I reckon you'll enjoy this." So I went out to the salt with him the following year, and the rest is history, as they say. So I've always been a motorcyclist. I've had a, you know, road racing, commuting, later on racing historics and things like that. So bikes have always been something that's preoccupied my space. But it was just a chance encounter with a person who I just met twice a year, that introduced me to the sport. And, we have been racing partners ever since. And I am ever so grateful that that is how it worked out.
Uh-huh. Okay, so Gary, I hope you... he's got thumbs up, so he's quite happy with that answer. Obviously, he's got...
Yeah. And Stephen, same question of you.
Well, it was a phone call in 2013, I think it was, from someone from the Surf Lifesaving Club at Aldinga to me, because I was listed as the publicity officer for the Levis Club, who said, "I'd like beach racing to happen at Selex again. Are the Levis Club interested?" And I spoke to the president at the time and said, "I've had this approach," and the answer was a language that I can't use, but it was a definite yes. And then
was fudge on there?
fudge, yes, I heard Ross say that last.
Yes.
Ross had said fudge. Yes, he said fudge, yes, we'd love to do that. And the next comment was, "And you and I are going to ride it." And I haven't had a serious race since then. Well, embarrassingly, early 1990s was when I did the Fink last. But no, we're going to go racing on the beach. And so there was then 4 years of getting a permit and doing all the jumping through the hoops and doing all those things and then organising the thing. And 6 weeks before the event, we built my bike. And I say we, it was Brenton Matters that built the bike. I passed tools to him. you know, this thing was, I've got photographs of it as a frame and bits and pieces, and we put this thing together, this little DKW together, and it just performed beautifully. And so I got to race on the beach, and then pose about it since, as you know.
Mm.
So it's been fantastic, and Emmy talked about the preparation, which I'm sure we'll go back to, because I'm really interested to hear what Kim says about her preparation, because it's, for us, it's always last minute and a dash to the finish to get there, because there's so many other things to do with the organisation. So, but we get there and we ride and we have a great time.
Yeah, that was actually a question that I pinched from Kathy just a short time ago. So I'll put my hand up for pinching it. Yeah, no, so, yeah, so again, it's that lifelong passion, or it's a passion that you've got for a particular sport, so in this case it's motorcycling, and, different things of what led you off into your various paths.
Well, I couldn't do the Fink again. I mean, I'm well and truly past that. You know, there's an age limit on that, I think, so you sort of move on and, you know, beach racing is at the really pointy end where Dave Johnson is doing a 0.59 or 59 second lap, which is a mile. So Kim will appreciate that. It's 60 miles an hour with two absolutely tight U turns at either end. The speed that he's doing down that beach is phenomenal and really, really impressive. Now, a 938 250 DKW is not approaching those speeds, It feels like no speed because of the lack of suspension and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm able to do it in my dotage.
I wish you'd actually have used a different word there, because unfortunately I think we can relate to that age quite well.
I can't. Right. I love the word in our days. I know Harold's not anywhere near there, but he's only a youngster. But anyway, it's great to... Well, what I actually seriously need to say is, as someone over 60, it's still great to be able to put on a helmet and compete and to be in the pits. Because, you know, and that's what it's about.
You're always in the pits.
Well, yeah, I'm in the pits most days, but it's great to be able to, and there's a lot of guys down there down at Selex that have been racing for a really long time. There's some legends that get there, and just to be able to hang out with them for the weekend and fantastic event to be able to do that. And it's, I come away buzzing from it because it's just, you get involved again. Which is great. So, leave the motocross to the young ones.
The young and stupid?
Yeah.
No,
they're not young and stupid. They're young and fit. That's the trouble.
And they've got bones that bend.
Actually, they're fearless. They're fearless too. And I think that's one of the things that Ross said last week, is that when you're younger, you're fearless. But as you get older, all of a sudden, fear comes into the
because you don't bounce as well.
No.
Exactly.
So that's something that I asked Kim. I won't ask you how old you are, because that would be rude. But, I mean, the speeds that you're talking about, how do you deal with that? You know, 249 miles an hour, that's an incredible speed.
I'll admit, Steve, I am a human, as are all my fellow racers. We scare ourselves. A good friend of mine... part of the American Salt family, Alan Lamb. Al Lamb, he summed it up really well, that when we come together for a week of speed trials, it's a week-long party celebrated by moments of sheer terror. I've been doing this since 2006, and if I'm lucky, I get to have a crack at this twice a year, so you don't get much practice, as you don't either, Stephen. You do rely on your instincts and your wit about things, and I have butterflies joining me right until the starter says go, and then luckily the butterflies always bugger off. And just get on with the job. It really, for me, with the racing and the speed that I do, I'm part of a team. There's three of us. There's Greg Waters and Jim Higgins and myself. And we do all the building. We also do all the braking and all the racing. Everything that we do, I know that anything I do on the bike will have an impact on Greg and Jim's life. As does everything they do on the bike, they know it has an impact on my life. And we have... I don't know, it's hard to describe it. It's this unconditional trust that we're doing the best that we possibly can. But we also know we're invincible and we're getting older. So I won't answer the question, but I'm closer to 60 than I am 40. So it does play on your mind that, do you have the reflexes that you need? Do you have the strength that you need? So the racing I do only lasts around about 5 minutes. One day I'm going to put a heart monitor on me, I think, just to see what does my heart get up to. I like to think I'm calm the whole time, but I'm sure I'm pumping around about 200 beats per minute. There's only so long that you've got that strength and that agility, and also the eyesight. You know, like, wow, quarter mile markers go past very fast. Like, it only takes me about 12 seconds to do a mile. I'm playing in a really narrow strip, you know. I've got a lot of things to look at, some of it on my dashboard and some of it just on my peripheral. And so it's not necessarily a sport. Going fast isn't necessarily a sport for getting older, but building bikes is a sport for the indefinite.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how old you are, you can build a machine that you can take the satisfaction of letting other people ride.
Yeah.
And I think
yeah.
for Dave, that's where, you know, thank goodness Dave's got someone amazing like Murray.
Yeah. So, Kim, that 5 minutes that you have, how long does it take for you to prepare to do that 5 minutes? So both body and...
A lifetime every ride. what does it take to actually prepare for Speed Week? I'd like to say it's a year of preparation, but just like Stephen said before, it's usually at the last minute because we're an amateur club. I'm an amateur racer. I've got a full-time job that isn't about racing as much as I'd love to be a racer. So usually it's around about a month, maybe 6 weeks before the Speed Week happens. It's a bit of a, oh no, oh fudge, we better do some preparation. And these days, I don't live as close to Greg as I used to. In fact, we're about 1,000 kilometres apart.
Mm.
So I don't do the mechanical work that I used to do with Greg. And so this year, that kind of was a bit of a noose around our neck that the bike ran relatively well last time we ran it back in 2019. And when we parked it, it then sat for 2 years because these are specialised machines. You don't run them anywhere else other than on the salt.
Mm.
So we only looked at the bike about 6 weeks ago and we store the bike with petrol in the system, but we race the bike with methanol. So we just did a little bit of preliminary tuning and everything seemed okay, but we were in hindsight, to self, tune it on the fuel that you're going to race it on. Mm-hmm. So we did a little bit of tuning on petrol, and then when we converted it to methanol, we had no compression, and in the end, we only discovered actually once we got on the salt that we only had about 60 pounds of pressure in all the pistons. So we were never going to go fast this year anyway. It's a tricky thing around the preparation, having enough time, the Pyrenees distance, and the expectations that you have on yourself as well as what others have on you. But also, we're always after continuous improvement. So there's the mechanical side. I'm sourcing a new engine. I'm looking for a late 90s S-Rad GSXR 750 and just plonk that motor in and we'll start from scratch again. We also are looking to... we're constantly thinking and designing in our minds new bodywork. What's the most aerodynamic we can be, both in the texture of the paintwork as well as the shape of the bodywork. So, you're thinking about it all the time, Kathy. Preparation, there's different scales of preparation. There's the thinking about it, and then there's actually rolling your sleeves up and getting the grease under your nails.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to manage a bit of the tyranny of time now, because we are running out of time. We've still got some more messages to go. So hang on a minute and we'll be back. And you're listening to Adelaide's Coast FM 88.7. This is Moto Chat, and we've got a couple of minutes left to talk to Kim and Stephen. And I believe that Ebi has a question for Stephen.
I just want to ask one word. I'd say one word, Stephen, and if I mention Bradbury, what does that mean to you?
So, great saying, and it's attributed to a lot of riders over the years. To finish first you must finish. And that's certainly the story of my weekend at Selex. I finished all four races, and to my huge surprise, I was top of the podium because of that.
Well put. I couldn't have put it more succinctly myself if I had tried. So walk us through. What did happen? Apart from the fact they didn't finish.
A bit like Kim was saying, my preparation didn't look particularly well. We couldn't get top speed out of the bike. We could get a good, at the start it was really fast, but just no top speed. It never looked like it was going to be a huge weekend. And then sort of things fell into our laps because those bikes that were much faster than I didn't finish their event. So it was four races. I finished all four. By the time we got to the fourth race, through attrition, I got a second place, which gave me a fistful of points. And I've seen the results. I won by 1 point. over the, so 71 points to 70 for second place. But just, a fistful of fourths and then a second, simply because the other bikes didn't finish. So I'll take it. It's a Bradbury for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
A world champion is a world champion. It doesn't matter how many points is in it. It's a champion.
It just means that you did better than the other guys on the day, and that's what counts.
You have to finish the races. So, yeah.
Precisely.
I'm looking at seeing Marquez is out, I might have a crack at MotoGP.
Okay, on that note, we
Mind through one though, Stephen. Didn't you say 1938 DJW?
Yeah.
Like, hello, that is so impressive. That's a 90-year-old machine.
It is beautiful. I love it. I hug it. It's a beautiful thing. And it's just, it's up against all English bikes, so I've sort of also taken on the, to the other guys that was on second and third, if you rode a German bike, you would have perhaps done all right. So it's a bit of fun.
Yeah. Guys, thanks so much, Kim Krebs and Stephen Matthews, for coming on the show. It's been great having you on again. And we look forward to another time that you can come in and talk to us. This is Moto Chat. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. And we've got Arnie Jack to take us out.
See you, fellas.